Linda Moulton Howe, an Emmy Award-winning television producer, investigative reporter. She is an author who goes directly to men and women at the forefront of science and environmental challenges and to firsthand eyewitnesses of high strangeness. She's a graduate of Stanford University with a master's degree in communication, and she has devoted her documentary, film, television, radio career to productions concerning science, medicine, and the environment with two incredible stories tonight. Linda Moulton Howe. Hello, Linda. How was your Thanksgiving?
Well, George, it was interesting that it was exactly 1 year ago that I left Philadelphia trying to get away from all the water and the flooding there and moved to beautiful Albuquerque, and then found myself going back almost exactly the same day to have Thanksgiving with some friends and relatives there, and thought, oh no, they're having one of those nor'easters, and gritting my teeth, I'm going to fly back into that weather that I was trying to escape. But something kept all that bad weather away, and it was beautiful. So I had a wonderful Thanksgiving there and back here.
Hey, yeah, the hour before you, Linda, tongue-in-cheek with a company that provides UFO abduction insurance, they pay out a $10 million policy at $1 a year. Now you're a tough, hard-nosed investigative reporter, but even you like a chuckle once in a while, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, but it's kind of ironic tonight that that would be the lead hour when what I'd like to share with you and Coast tonight are two really fascinating hours that, to me, combine what we're going to hear from this former Minister of Defense from Canada combined with a U.S. Air Force pilot retired. It seems to me that every month of every year, we're getting closer to sort of like the scale is getting heavier and heavier on the eyewitness testimony from people who were firsthand in governments and they know what they're talking about.
Maybe one day, Linda, there will be some real UFO abduction insurance.
Well, maybe that's where all this is headed. But, you know, it was 8 years ago, on July 4th, 1997, I was in Roswell, New Mexico, and it was the 50th anniversary of that famous UFO crash that was discovered by the rancher named Mac Brazel near Corona. And as we all know now, almost around the world, U.S. military and intelligence units retrieve wreckage that somebody said it has to be dismissed as a weather balloon. But joining us in that anniversary celebration back in Roswell 8 years ago was an Army man who declared, I mean, it was strongly stated, the crash and crashes were definitely extraterrestrial, and it was not the only one that the United States government had covered up. And that person making those strong words was U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso. He, at that anniversary in Roswell, he released his groundbreaking book, The Day After Roswell. And Colonel Corso wrote astonishing details in that book about U.S. government programs to retrieve extraterrestrial technology from downed craft and to back engineer and patent it inside American corporations. And at my website, www.earthfiles.com, I have a report of this former Minister of Defense, his interview, plus a list by Colonel Corso himself of what he said was ET technology that we were back engineering in the United States, and it included fiber optics and night vision. And he also told me that he had been seen with his own eyes highly classified documents dated as early as 1951. That's only 4 years after 47 Roswell. About unusual deaths of animals around the world in which similar patterns of tissue were taken without blood, tracks, or signs of struggle. And the documents identified the mutilators as, quote, extraterrestrial biological entities, unquote, according to Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso. Well, recently, at a September 2005 Exopolitics Symposium that was organized by Mike Bird in Toronto, one speaker with 50 years of Canadian government service said Colonel Corso was right. that there are extraterrestrial entities and ET advanced technologies. His name is Paul Hellyer, who was Canada's Minister of Defense from 1963 to 1967 when Pierre Trudeau was Prime Minister. Before then, Mr. Hellyer had been an elected Member of Parliament and was Associate Minister of Defense. After his MOD work, he was appointed Minister of Transport and Housing from 67 to 69, and he stayed in the Parliament House until 1974. His recent frankness was provoked by contact, he said, with an American Air Force general who said, quote, "Every word in Colonel Philip J. Corso's book is true and more," unquote. Further, Paul Hellyer thinks that the public has a right to know what governments know. Since senators in the Canadian Parliament are appointed until age 75 and they don't have to worry about re-elections, Mr. Hellyer is urging some of them to organize public Parliament hearings about what he says is a UFO ET presence. And this week I asked Paul Hellyer what the United States Air Force General told him in the past few months that was so convincing. And here is an excerpt from that interview.
Here it is. Very special interview.
There have been visitors from space, and that they were as real as the airplanes flying overhead, and that they were designated by Nathan Twining as enemy aliens, and that the United States appeared to be following a military course which would put them in a position to be able to shoot down some of these vehicles. And knowing the military, that causes me some concern, because I don't know whether they're a real threat to the United States and the world or whether they aren't. And I think we should find out more about it and know more about it so that the public is in on the debate and not just leave it to the generals and the top civil servants who think they own all this information.
And the U.S. Air Force general retired did comment to you about Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso's book, The Day After Roswell.
Yes, indeed. Well, he said that it was all true. And he said every word of it is true and more. And he did elaborate a little bit in that he said that there had been face-to-face discussions.
Between
the alien visitors and members of the United States government or armed forces or both.
And did he explain if our government still felt that these were enemy aliens, as Nathan Twining had assigned that phrase to them in the 1947 time period?
No, and I think he, if anything, he gave me the impression that maybe they weren't that concerned. But I don't know, you know, I want to be careful with that one. But he didn't seem to be as concerned about the potential consequences of some accidental or deliberate destruction of the space vehicles as I did.
And if he was not concerned when you talked with him, what, within the last year?
Yes.
Then what is his major concern?
I think he may be writing a book too. And I don't know what his major concern is, but he certainly, I think, feels that, you know, there should be more public disclosure than there has been. That certainly, otherwise he wouldn't have taken the trouble to verify that what Colonel Corso had said was basically correct.
And this is a name of a United States Air Force general that we all would know if we heard it?
I doubt it, no.
But he held a capacity in which he had firsthand knowledge about extraterrestrial biological entities?
I can't even answer that, but he certainly had there was no hesitation in his voice whatsoever. You know, it wasn't a question of, you know, I've heard rumors or something like that. It was just bang, every word is true and more.
And if it's all true, then it means face-to-face encounters with extraterrestrial biological entities, the retrieval of advanced technologies, and efforts to back-engineer those technologies in the United States?
Yes, I would say so.
The U.S. Air Force retired general that you talked with describe in any form the types of non-humans that the government of the United States is dealing with?
No.
But he talked about more than one type.
Yes.
I mean, they could still consider something to be a threat.
They could, absolutely. And if there's a real threat, I think the people have a right to know about it. That would give some legitimacy to some of the American military plans. After I made the speech recently, I was talking to a woman who said that her, I guess it was her son, was an airline pilot. And they were shadowed all the way across the country, and every time they came in to contact with another radar, they would ask that they track these vehicles. And then finally, when they got into Toronto and they were went into a debriefing room, why, they were just told again, it didn't happen, you didn't see anything.
And the shadowing you're referring to is that the pilots knew that something that they couldn't identify as an airplane was trailing their plane.
Right, exactly, trailing or alongside.
Why do you think, when you were Minister of Defense in 1963 to 67, that you didn't see anything about the UFO phenomenon then?
I don't know. I'm very curious. Actually, you know, I got reports of sightings, but all the reports said beside each sighting was either an explanation or no explanation.
And when you tried to follow up, what happened?
I didn't try to follow up because I was too busy doing other things. It wasn't at the top of my agenda by any means.
Hmm. And today in 2005, learning what you are learning, how would you translate that lack of information back in the 60s? Was somebody deliberately trying to keep the Minister of Defense in Canada out of the extraterrestrial UFO loop?
I don't think so, but you never know, because often they call the permanent government doesn't like to share information with politicians.
In other words, those that are not elected and have access to highly classified information consider the elected to be transitory and not having a need to know?
Absolutely.
Well, that's my understanding in the United States as we speak in 2005.
Yeah. Is it true that Jimmy Carter tried to find out something and was told that he wasn't cleared for it?
That's my understanding. And if this is the case in your government, in our government now, what do you think it is going to take to change this policy of denial in the interests of national security?
Well, it's going to take a high public awareness that really demands, to know the facts.
But it's catch 22. How do we get to high awareness when the governments have drawn these solid block walls against the public and the media knowing facts?
Well, that's the reason for the hearing, in the hope that there will be another hearing, more important one, south of the border, where there are more witnesses that can come forward and where hopefully the mainline press would find it impossible to deny the importance of it.
And the importance of this is understanding the cover-up, George. And in just a few sentences, in the day after Roswell, Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso said, quote, "As the military tried to figure out what it was that had crashed, where it had come from, and what its inhabitants' intentions were, a covert group was assembled under the leadership of the Director of Intelligence, Admiral Roscoe Hillenketter, who was the first director of the CIA, to investigate the nature of the flying disks and collect all information about encounters with these phenomena, while at the same time, publicly and officially, discounting the existence of all flying saucers. This operation has been going on in one form or another for more than 50 years amid complete secrecy," unquote.
Linda, nice job on this. First of all, when the Hell Your Story broke last week, I said this could be one of the biggest UFO disclosure stories I've seen in a long time.
Right.
And I do have to tell you, about 6 months ago, you might remember, I was talking about some government officials were working on a plan to go for full disclosure. And after hearing you talking with Hellyer, I am convinced that that is very, very close now. I was called about 3 weeks ago from someone who's working with them, and he merely said, "George, we're just finalizing some things that we're working on. But it's going to be very soon. When that happens, rest assured, I'm bringing you in on it with me, because it is supposed to be major. And maybe this Paul Hellyer disclosure might be the beginning, might be the step that they were waiting for, and he may very well be aware of them. I have a feeling they're looking for someone to, as we used to say in football, create some daylight for some runners, and he may be the one doing that right now.
And what's interesting to me, as we go into this break, that I'm going to have some comments from a United States Air Force man on this crash burial in Utah. And in all cases, what keeps being raised by everybody is, could one of these intelligences out there still be considered a quote-unquote enemy alien, as General, or as Nathan Twining, General Nathan Twining said in 47? And if so, why? And if there is that point of view, what would there be about 2006 that they've decided that they have to open up no matter what is out there?
What a story. I mean, absolutely stunning. And, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. There's a bigger story here, Linda.
Yo, there's so much more to unfold. And technology, this gigantic issue of what we have that is from off-planet, that has been being developed and put into technology today, is perhaps also a very sensitive button, because if governments and corporations have patented and made money off of a subject that they have said to so many people it doesn't exist, that might be a little embarrassing at some point for governments.
Were you surprised by Hellyer's apparent nonchalant attitude about the UFOs? I mean, I would have been, even considering the position he had as Minister of Defense, I would have been more excitable about this.
Well, he said in another part of our interview, when I asked him about what was happening in 63 to 67 specifically, was he getting reports from the United States? Because that was a huge time in terms of animal mutilations and craft sightings. And he said no, that the reports that came to his desk were exactly as he said. They were generated from inside Canada. But an interesting thing, it was back in Corso's book. He said that he and General Trudeau, who were working in the Eisenhower administration, that they contacted this Dr. Wilbert Smith, who was also working in the Department of Transport. This is long before Paul Hellyer, but they were urging the government of Canada to investigate the nature of alien technology. Mm-hmm. There was this Canada-U.S. link, and why was Paul Hellyer kept out of any kind of an intimate loop? That's why I asked him the question, could it have been calculated?
I got to tell you, Linda, your next story may be one of the biggest I've ever heard in a very long time. You are talking about a possible crashed UFO in 1953 in a dry lake bed near Garrison, Utah. This is a major story. If you go to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the picture linked up with Linda's earthfiles.com that she has sent us of this triangular-shaped object that truly looks like a very large UFO that was apparently buried. We'll be back with her in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. Now, Linda, this picture that you sent us that's now on the coasttocoastam.com website via your earthfiles.com website, tell us a little bit about the picture first, if you would, and then we'll go into the story.
Right. It is really important, and it goes back to 1993 when there were some UFO investigators who had talked with a former United States Air Force captain who told them that he knew through a friend who worked in the Defense Intelligence Agency that the Dress Lake Bed, this lake bed is near a facility that is a desert research place, and they call it Dress, that there had been a very large, what he said was, UFO from outer space vehicle that had crashed in that lake bed in the year 1953, and it was too big and had to be buried. And when these investigators, on the basis of that conversation, went on their own to this what looks always like an abandoned facility. You would never believe that it was actually operational. That's why a lot of people think it's like a intelligence safe house hiding in plain sight.
Yep.
They, let's put it this way. They went down a coal chute, and they got into a basement, and there they found 24 large, high-altitude aerial photographs. And at my website, earthfiles.com, in this four-part series that I'm doing on this dress, we'll call it the Dress Lake Bed crash burial, I have several photographs that show from the original 1953, has the date, June 11th, 1953, when all of these large photographs were taken, one of which is at Earth Files, and some others. And I come up into the modern day at the end of the 90s, and I also show a USGS Terra server image from a satellite. And that triangular feature is as prominent today as it was in those June 11th, 1953 photos. And part of the story is that investigators went to a geologist with those aerial photographs and said, what could make this? And the geologist did some work out there at the site and said, this is not nature. This is not runoff. This is something that was constructed, meaning there had to be construction. And this triangle in that photograph, as I point out at Earth Files, is huge. It's 4,400 feet on the long sides and 2,700 feet on the shorter side. Right.
And, how high is it?
Well, I have a photograph trying to give scale. I'm down in what is essentially the top of the triangle. And when you're in there, you think that you're on total flat land. This was one of the strangest things. I was there in July, and I tried to find the edges. I had looked at all these aerial photographs, and I wanted to find the edges. And the funny thing about it is, not just my experience, but other investigators, you cannot get a sense of that triangular edge when you're actually on the lake bed.
And you say it's triangular. John Lear says that it's more like a flattened egg, almost oval, very close. You're both probably pretty accurate there.
Well,
it does look, it's got some dimension to it.
He saw my presentation on this for the first time just about 2 or 3 weeks ago in Vegas. And he and Ron Blackburn had been doing their own independent investigation, and I think what he meant was they and I and others have done some remote viewing that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes.
Okay.
And they're talking about the center of the triangle where they think this thing came down and was buried. The triangle itself is a huge mammoth triangle, not to be confused. The triangular construction, I believe, relates to a military project with bulldozers. The object would be in the middle of that triangle if you look at earthfiles.com and
okay.
those photos.
That explains it then.
And when you go into this four-part report, the fourth one is with remote viewing by the talented Joe McMonagall. And he did a fascinating drawings. And you see what he saw as a remote viewer coming down. And to give some history to this, let's go back 52 years ago on May 20th of 1953. That is a date that has come up through the UFO investigation world as something supposedly crashing near Kingman, Arizona. Now, what no one has talked about is the fact that 3 weeks later, on this date of June 11th, 1953, if you draw a straight line on a map, you can go right straight north, 200 miles from Kingman to this dry lake bed east of the Fish Lake National Forest. And we know that we've got these photographs, at least 24, with dates on them of June 11th, 1953, of this
okay.
huge, huge triangular feature. And, George, they did a grid pattern. The photographs are overlapping grids. Somebody was focused on that triangle for unknown reasons.
Hmm.
And it's only 3 miles away. That is what is called the Desert Research Experimental Station, that some people call DRESS, the because it's the acronym. Well, okay. It's interesting that that was built in 1933, a CCC project, and it was designed to try to deal with how do you, when there's drought and dryness, what do? How do you make plants? How do you help ranchers during a drought time? What can you do to help with drought? That's how this DRES facility came about. But over the years, and I'm going to go right to something that one of the investigators told me on 9/11, that very day, at the night, it was a total fluke. They just happened to have made an investigation trip out, and they said that the DRES facility that is supposed to be managing desert plants was lighted up on the night of September 11th, 2001, and stayed lighted for a week.
Weird.
Okay. Now, the location of this triangle is also 175 miles south of that highly classified Dugway Proving Ground. We don't know if there's a connection at all.
Right, okay.
But this United States Air Force pilot says that he has firsthand knowledge that a large aerial vehicle, this is a quote, not from this world, unquote, impacted in 1953 where the triangle feature was dug to bury the craft and perhaps to provide, this is interesting, to provide a permanent marker in the lake bed for some kind of targeting, perhaps by the non-humans, but the exact purpose of that huge triangle is still unknown. And two Californians that I know, Lester Velez and Steve Jones, they became convinced by both of the retired U.S. Air Force men, the captain and this pilot. Both of the men said a large UFO had crashed, it was too big to transport, it had been buried, and recently I was able to talk with the pilot who requests anonymity, and here is an excerpt from that interview.
Okay, I can't wait for this one. Here we go.
What I understand from Steve Jones is that you were on a recovery team?
Well, in the airport, which I'm not going to talk about, with all kinds of things. I can't talk about it. They will shoot me.
Were those things related to the extraterrestrial biological entity phenomenon?
You're making it hard. I can't talk about that stuff. They weren't from this world, let's put it that way.
Okay. And what is your personal firsthand knowledge about the dry lake bed triangle that is in the high altitude photographs dated June 11th, 1953?
Well, that's a crash that happened back in late 52, early 53. I don't remember exact date now, but it crashed there, not in Kingman, and they buried it there.
And do you know for a fact that some sort of extraterrestrial vehicle was buried inside of that area that is the triangular pattern near the DRES facility?
Well, the ship was 150 feet in diameter. It was an oblong ship. It was about three stories high. Now, you can't pack that up on a car and drive it off. You can't helicopter it out. And the metal, you can't cut it up. So they got to put it somewhere.
And what is the source of your information? Can you?
That ought to tell you.
And what did our government do?
Start digging a big hole.
How did they do that?
With a lot of army guys and shovels. I mean, they dug for days and days and days and days. It's pretty sandy out there, so it's pretty easy. Bulldozers and whatnot.
But burying something that's three stories high, that's at least 30 feet high, mm-hmm. by 50 feet in diameter, that's pretty big.
Well, half it was already buried when I finally settled down, so I had to dig the other half out.
It's still buried in October of 2005, as far as you know?
As far as I know, yeah. I haven't been there in probably a good 10 years or so. and it was there when I lived there last. So.
And is the dress facility a hiding in plain sight intelligence operation in which there are underground facilities to access the buried craft?
Well, it used to be. It's not active anymore, but there used to be some underground walkway to the site and into the ship.
And you know that firsthand?
And I walked in the ship myself.
And do you know which type of entity it's linked with?
The Zeta Reticulan.
The gray-skinned ones with the vertical-pupiled reptilian eyes?
The small gray, yeah, I guess that's what you call them, yeah. They're not really reptilian eyes, but okay.
Well,
brown, black eyes. But.
Do you have any understanding why the 1953 aerial that was taken on June 11th shows a large triangular unnatural pattern? Why a triangle?
Who knows? That those people did all kinds of weird things.
In other words, that the digging and the burying, leaving that triangular pattern, may have been for some reason.
There's probably some aerial reason for the ships to come in and land. Most likely, you might guess.
Now, George, that is probably one of the more powerful statements that I've heard from somebody saying that they had firsthand, even going in something that was underground that was supposed to be, quote-unquote, not from this world.
This guy's dead serious, Linda. He sounds like he means exactly what he's saying.
Yeah, exactly. And I talked about all this with MJ-12 researcher Ryan Wood. And Ryan has worked a lot on cases with Joe McMonagle of the Intuitive Intelligence Applications in Virginia.
Right.
He's maybe one of the most talented remote viewers around. And I prepared a sealed envelope that had only a Xerox of one of the June 11th, 1953 aerial photographs in that envelope. It had the latitude, longitude on the back of the photograph. I taped the envelope. I did vertical lines along the glued and the taping. So if anything were torn open at all, I mean in the slightest, those vertical lines would be broken. And I got the envelope back after the remote viewing was done completely and totally as I had sent it. And the first reviewing sketch was done on October 13th, and it sort of stunned me. It's in one of my reports at Earth Files, and the first thing that he got, he drew a triangle. He indicated the pattern in the desert location. He had the directions right. He had the point headed exactly the way it is, everything. And with his sketch, he had those lists of first impressions that people get.
Yeah.
Low mountains on the horizon, desert floor, feeling like I'm in the desert southwest, ground pattern, possibly medium to large, well-defined but slightly worn, triangular in shape, even-sided on two edges, slightly smaller or shorter on the third edge, pattern is a ground indentation, downward sloping from indentation at edges. And here is something strange he got wrong, but I'm going to talk about the implications. He said the size is approximately 60 meters or feet on a side. Well, we know from the geology survey that it's 4,400 feet long. And I've talked about this with Ryan. Is it possible that in the remote viewing, that Joe McMonagle was picking up a previous crash in the lake bed of a smaller object that might have happened in the 1940s, because there's a lot more to this remote viewing. And I know we're coming up to the break. I'll just give you a few highlights, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about this after the break and before calls.
Sure.
This is what he went beyond the sketch. The indentation was created by two large machines which cut approximately 1.5 feet of topsoil from the surface, removing it. And we know we've heard about that in other UFO crash retrieval cases. Soil was removed to clean up what appears to be some kind of an impact site or what might be a vehicle crash site. Remember, he doesn't know anything we're talking about. He's just doing remote viewing on a closed envelope. Removal of toxic waste or material possibly being carried by a vehicle that impacted in the center of the area of the triangle pattern. There was more soil removed from the center than the edges. That's very consistent with what the Air Force men said. Original vehicle probably impacted at an angle. All traces of impacting vehicle were removed. Date of impact was approximately 1938 to 40. That is an entire decade and a couple of years before 1953.
How many are there? Yeah, absolutely.
So this is a very interesting question. He's got so much right. Why would the size and the date? Is it possible that two things happened out there? And we can talk about this after the break, because I interview people who live out in that Garrison Baker area. And I'm telling you, George, they have seen some weird things back
that
in the 50s.
True. And quick question, why hasn't anybody really attempted to excavate out there?
Well, it's federal property.
So what's on top of it?
It's a lake bed.
But there's no lake bed. No building, there's nothing up there, no other structures on top of that?
Nothing. The lake bed is a dry lake bed, and you can see the cracked white soil in the photographs that I've got at Earth Files.
Well, we got to get some kind of airborne radar or something to penetrate and take a look at that.
Exactly.
It's got to be done. Got to be done. Okay, Linda, stay with us. We'll continue talking with you about this incredible story, and then we'll also open up the phone lines. And I tell you what, I do want to go into open lines later tonight, but at least next hour, you keep calling. We'll keep talking with Linda Moulton Howe on some incredible stories here. Absolutely stunning. Back now with Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, is anybody going to do any testing to see what this structure, what this object might be?
Well, in terms of doing something like radar penetration or something to even see if it's still there.
Yes.
I'll just put it this way, that there may be something unfolding in the next few months. But if the Air Force pilot statement that it might have been there in the mid-90s, but he doesn't really know now, is it possible that it has been moved? That's still a question. But you have to assume that the government was doing anything and everything they could in terms of analysis in an underground way if it was, in fact, buried in that dry lake bed. So they would know what you're asking, but the Air Force people and I don't know.
Well, and I do have to say that if an object of that size crashed, and if you look at the Phoenix Lights structure and what people reportedly saw, it sounds kind of similar. If something that big crashed, there's no way in the 1950s, and there may be no way today, that we'd have the kind of capability and technology to pull that thing out. And then to dismantle the whole thing is unrealistic. They had to bury it.
Yeah, and it is not the first case that I've been told, at least off the record, that there have been other incidents in which there have been craft that are defined by the sources as extraterrestrial that were too large to be handled and that they were buried. And what has happened to these buried craft is another part of the mystery. But there is a very interesting part of the Joe McMonagle remote viewing that goes to this issue of what was it made out of that you're asking about.
Right.
And he attached some drawings of what he thought happened when this object came in, and he said the craft's physical description, tubular, as opposed to being circular, because when you look at the drawing, it just means more oval. And it was traveling in excess of 3,000 miles an hour. It was constructed of a material made from a metallic alloy consisting of aluminum oxide, nearly 100% pure.
Now, this was in his remote viewing, right?
This is all I'm reading directly from his notes.
Okay.
Aluminum oxide, nearly 100% pure, titanium, and an element, something like nickel and copper mixed, but with a couple of extra molecules, which is a very interesting comment.
Mm-hmm.
There were no onboard life forms. Now, this is a discrepancy, a distinct discrepancy with the U.S. Air Force pilot. again, is there a mixture here, an overlay in timelines, remote viewing? Joe McMonagle is considered to be one of the most accurate. But what if he picked up on something else that was a drone?
I was going to say, maybe it's not a life form. Maybe it's not biological, Linda. Maybe it's robotic.
And that there may have been two incidents there, and the second one may be the one that the U.S. Air Force pilot is talking about, in which he said there were definitely what they called Zeta Reticulan entities. So there are these discrepancies that at least provoke the discussion about what exactly did happen out in that desert dry lake bed. I told you I had interviewed several ranchers and people out there, and one of the most interesting stories came from a man. He goes back, he and his family were there long before the 50s, but he described riding on a horse, and I believe it was morning, and he saw an object coming slowly toward him. It was oval. It was solid black to his eyes. He couldn't see any silver. And he said that it was like looking into infinity. Well, that strange description of a black something that doesn't seem to have an end, a black infinity, has also come up in a few cases in which people have seen very bizarre objects that don't fall into the silver category. And that was right out there at the dry lake bed, again, going back into the 50s. So a whole bunch of stuff may have been happening. And Joe McMonagle goes on and says, this is remote viewing now. The drive system was a form of electronic pulsed heat wave forms through some kind of tunnel system. Not clear at all what that would be. It was rapidly spinning, but it was not out of control. It was designed to self-destruct after entering an atmosphere and following the completion of its mission. Its mission was and is unknown, unquote.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Linda, I got to tell you, these two stories, both the Paul Hellyer story and this specific one, truly remarkable. And we've got to be able to somehow penetrate and find out what this is.
Well, I'll tell you one other footnote before we go to phone calls, because I find this a very interesting part of this story. When the investigators in 93 went down that coal chute, in addition to all of those aerial photographs, they found a visitor's logbook dated 1980 to 1983. That's going back 23 years ago. In this logbook, here are some of the agencies that were, I saw this, I have copies of this, that had written themselves into the logbook. Now remember, this is supposed to be a desert experimental range office. Here is a list of some of the people in 80 to 83. United States Army personnel from Fort Carson, Colorado. Headquarters, U.S. Air Force Research and Development. Naval Research Laboratory, Washington, D.C. U.S. Army Special Forces, USAIMA from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and I had never heard of USAIMA before. It stands for United States Army Institute for Military Assistance, and this was a 10th Special Forces group that was originally created in 52, a year before the alleged Kingman and Dress events, and this Army unit's primary mission was to infiltrate by land, sea, or air deep into enemy-occupied territory, conduct special forces operations, and it specialized in, quote, tactics of unconventional warfare. Why were they out there? Others that signed into the dress logbook were EG&G from Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada, highly involved in the Groom Lake and Area 51 operations. And Morton Thiokol, based in northern Utah. This is the company which built the external tanks for the NASA space shuttle. So you combine these pieces of sort of hard evidence from a facility with what the retired Air Force captain and this pilot said about having firsthand knowledge about this odd event or events out in that lake bed, and you can see why that there is this issue of a quote-unquote intelligent safe house hiding in plain sight out there with these kinds of agencies coming and going.
All right, to the phones we go. Nice job tonight, Linda.
Thank you.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. Where are you calling from?
Temple, Texas.
Welcome to the show, sir. Sure, go ahead, Chuck.
Good evening, George, Linda.
Hi.
All right, I'd wanted to call and mention something that had occurred to me before. This is about when I was 9 years old, myself and a friend of mine included. We seen a triangular-shaped craft one night. It was like it was entering into Earth's atmosphere, similar to what you would see if you were in a swimming pool and an object was coming into the water. It had a very, you know, otherworldly type look to it. Now, when it solidified in Earth's atmosphere, it took off. Well, I-10 wasn't even built then, but it was headed directly due west along the old Highway 90 route. This occurred in Lafayette, Louisiana. Now, the way you described the object, triangular, and the size of it especially, it seems to have similarities to the ones that I've seen. And what really stood out in my mind was it was close enough where I could see the hull itself, and you could see furrows along the length of it as if it had struck objects while it was actually traveling.
There's a couple of things. The shape of the object remote viewed at the Dress facility in Utah was oval, not triangular. The confusion there is that this huge triangular structure in the dry lake bed that the remote viewer and the Air Force people said was constructed around the burial of this oval object. So it was not a triangular object that went into the lake bed. But there have been large triangular objects. I, in fact, have a fascinating story at Earth Files right now on a new book about a huge black triangle that was over four people in North Carolina in 1996. And the description of that huge triangle, they said that they were looking up and they could see, I think they used the term, tons of stars as if they went right up to a straight line. And then there was another straight line, and everything in between was this big black triangle, which, George, you know, for those of us who have interviewed a lot of people the March 13th, 1997 event in Phoenix, that was the same description on that huge triangle there, blocking out. They could see stars around these straight edges. And there were the real estate people and that family that was driving in from Tucson, and they had reasons on the ground to estimate that the size of those triangles were nearly 2 miles long. So we have a wide panoply when it comes to what this, like this man is describing. He's seen triangles. I do not doubt it. And other people have seen smaller triangles in the approximately 300 to 600 foot range. What is responsible for all of these sizes? Well, in this new book, The Black Triangle Incident by Bill Foster, they find out in under hypnosis that there was an abduction and that they are dealing with some form of a gray entity inside of this, apparently, this huge triangular craft.
Is there something unusual about the site itself? And, you know, what are the coordinates out there, the longitude, the latitude?
I have those at Earth Files in my reports. Let me see if I don't think I have them right here at this file, but I put them exactly in, let's see if I do have it here. I don't write here in these pieces of paper, but
okay.
You can
well,
get
if,
it
if
from,
you get it during the questioning, too, just
right.
Pop
and, but
back
one
over.
Of the important things about the, what this man said is when they were in the triangle and they were getting telepathic communication from these entities, it was, and this is so hard to understand, that neither time nor size had any relevance to them. Hmm. And the man, Bill Foster, was very confused and kept trying to understand this, and they said they made whatever size they needed. Well, maybe there is something we're just totally missing about the universe and matter, meaning that we're not advanced enough, that there is that these sizes that we are seeing are either an illusion from our part, or there's something going on with matter and energy that they have control over that is beyond our comprehension. I found that very interesting, because in so many other abduction cases, so many people have said that time, our time is not their time. And it is possible, if you go to Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2, as the U.S. Air Force pilot discussed, that is a binary star system. It's a distant binary star system, but it's possible that there are systems with planets and advanced life in which there would not be night as we know night.
That's true.
And if so, then there wouldn't be markings for time, quote unquote, the way we live in a day-night cycle. And the physics of a binary star system of planets may be different in some way, or maybe hugely different from our solar system. These are fascinating questions to explore. And the other thing that this caller mentioned that I think is, to me, definitely worth emphasizing, and that is, people have described when they've seen some craft or even entities, they will use the term, you know what it looks like when on a hot day when you're looking down a highway and you see the shimmers, you see mirages. So many people have used that metaphor, saying the entity seemed to come through, or the craft that they're seeing seemed to come through the shimmering like heat waves. Well, is that because whatever it is, it's causing some kind of distortion in the magnetic spectrum, and so it's affecting photons, it's affecting everything that is reaching the human eye? Those are all questions that I don't have answers to, but the descriptions by eyewitnesses like this gentleman are very similar.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jeff from Salt Lake City. Hi, George.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks.
I had a question for Linda. If one were to see a meteor falling from the sky, could you describe what they would see? And then I also had a question for George, if I can.
Well, I've been an amateur astronomer since I was 4 years old, and I have spent thousands of hours outside in night skies with telescopes. And my answer would be, I have seen all kinds of appearances of meteors in the sky, depending upon the size. And if you have a bolide, which is a large rock, you know, you might get a flaring orange or red or yellow, and it looks fiery. Or for the most part, if they're dust grains or little pebbles, that's where you see the white glowing streaks that can last for a portion of a second, or in some of the larger Leonids and Perseid showers, you might see something that goes across the sky. But for the most part, when we see that in the sky, they are disintegrating there. It's very few that actually get to the ground. So there's a wide range of what you see.
Would it have a trail, for example?
Well, all to the visible eye. If you're watching a meteorite in the sky, you almost always see some kind of a trail.
Yeah, as quickly as it is. Depends on how it breaks up, Jeff. Looked at the old clock, and boy, this night is going by quickly. And you know, Linda, this year is going by fast, isn't it?
It's absolutely true. Is time speeding up, or is it just because we're living longer, or what? What do you think?
I think it might be a combination of everything, because I just can't believe it. Did you know this April will be my 5 years of being associated with Coast to Coast?
Has it really been that long?
5 years, yeah. It'll be 3 full-time, 2 part-time when I was filling in for Art, but 5 years, I can't believe it.
Wow.
Let's go back to the phones. People have been waiting for you for a long time.
All right, and I have those latitude.
Oh, you got them now? Okay, sure. What are they?
113 West, 40, I think it's 40 minutes 29.83. So it's that 40 and the what? Isn't that how that reads? 40.29.83?
I was a Navy public affairs officer. I didn't have to look at coordinates and maps.
So it's 113 West, space, okay. 40, and what I would call a foot, you know, a mark for a foot, and then 29.83, and what I call a mark for seconds, by 38 North, space, 37, with the footmark.
All right. If there's anybody there who understands this and you want to use these coordinates to find it on a search map, go ahead. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to our wildcard line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Am I on?
Yes, sir. It's all
fantastic.
Yours.
Hey, George. It's Greg from New Jersey. Actually,
hey,
I'm on TerraServer.com right now, and your longitudinal coordinates are -113.67, and the latitude is 38.63.
Oh, well, thanks.
And that's all we needed. 31.63? Okay.
Yeah, and this thing is gigantic. I'm waiting for Hoagland to get on right now, talking about faces on Mars, because that's what I'm looking. That's what it looks like. Because there's not only is there the gigantic triangle that Linda talked about, there's a secondary set of excavation marks, clear as day, some 400 and something yards across. This thing is gigantic, and I can't wait to see if they can get some infrared or some sort of spectral analysis going on over that to see what's going on underneath it.
Right, 4,400 feet on a side is, you know, that's almost a mile long on each side and 2,700 feet wide.
Well, if you go to TerraServer.com, you can see the secondary set of excavation that has gone on there.
That looks triangular there at the far wider wedge end.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And it's as clear as day. And I tell you, I got to hand it to you, Linda. You really hit a home run on this one. So.
Thank you. Well, there have been others before me who talked about it, and that's what provoked the interest of investigators who contacted me. So that means there were people in the Air Force who felt like somebody ought to pay attention there.
That is a very bizarre sight, Linda. It may be more important than Roswell.
Interesting comment, yes. And it's to me, in talking with Ryan Wood in the new book he's got out, with 74 to 75 different alleged, we'll call them pieces of crash retrieval stories, if there have been 74 or 75 in the United States and other parts of the world, why? Are we shooting them down? Is there something about them that are some of them Trojan horses planned to be crashes? Is there something about interactions in our atmosphere or magnetic fields? There's so many questions about why would there be so many crashes of advanced technology.
I'm told that the latitude that the caller just gave us, that Greg just gave us, is the latitude of Cydonia in Mars. Now, can you believe that?
No.
That's what I'm told.
Huh.
I'll do a little more checking on that. I'll get onto my... Okay. I've got a red phone here that Richard C. Hoagland is hooked up to, and it rings every once in a while. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Ralph in Escondido. By the way, latitude is degrees, minutes, and seconds.
Thank you.
Linda, why didn't you take the obvious instrument, a metal detector, to find this huge mass and trace its outline much like the movie The Thing? I mean, that would have told you right away if there's a huge metal mass of hundreds of tons below the surface.
Okay. My visit there was to interview people, see the site, and see if I could go further than what others had done, which included a geologist who died earlier this year, who had gone out with some equipment to see if they could find anything through using a seismometer and some other instruments. But turns out that the two places that the geologist was concentrating on were at the two far ends of the triangle. And according to the remote viewer and the Air Force pilot, this burial, assuming that it occurred, was right in the center of the triangle. And right now, I've come into this this year after some of that work, and I am trying to work with some people about doing some more investigation. But on that trip this summer, it wasn't with the idea of spending money and time and equipment going out there for that reason. It was to do interviews of people who might have more information about what happened in the 50s.
You could walk a metal detector probably three or four abreast and walk that whole area and find out very quickly if there's something that massive on the surface.
That meter should be going crazy.
Yeah.
It's, well, and it's something I would, if somebody wants to do it, when we were out there, it was, I think, 100 and some degrees. It was hot and brutal. And the length of time it would take to go over 4,400 feet by 2,700 feet using that kind of an approach, I don't know. I personally would like to see somebody do deep penetrating radar.
Well, I just thought that would be quick and dirty. It's something you could hold on a vehicle, I think, and
well,
just drag it across the site.
Yeah, the geologists that I describe in my reports did do some work, but the whole area is so huge, they were at two ends, but they weren't in the right area.
That's a good idea, though. Let's go to our international line. Where are you calling from? You're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, George. It's David from Edmonton in the Nighthawk Bill.
Hi, David. Good to have you with us.
Yeah. I just wanted to make a couple comments and then ask my question of Linda. Right now, with this Paul Hollier story, I really don't think it's going to end up going anywhere, to be honest with you.
Why is that, David?
Right now, we are in the middle of an election campaign. We don't have a government at the moment. Ours was voted down by the opposition. And so basically, the current government can ignore this, and it'll just fade away, and I will lay money that they will.
But remember, I've talked with Paul Hollier about this issue, and he stressed the point that the senators, and that's who he's talking with, the senators are appointed basically on lifetime appointments to age 75. So
yeah.
They are not under the pressure of re-election.
No, they're not. But the senators in our government don't have any real power to be able to affect that same kind of change. And
well, we're talking about hearings. And the idea is that if Canada would start doing hearings with pilots and eyewitnesses up there, that maybe they might be able to cross-pollinate to senators in Washington and others to open up public hearings here, which a lot of people have wanted. But as you know, in the United States, no matter how many efforts there have been for so-called disclosure, Congress looks the other way.
Yeah, our Senate does not hold hearings in the same way that the American one does. Our Senate is basically a second government to go over bills again and make changes to those bills after they've been approved by our government. So, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like there's going to be a lot of change. And
I don't know that Paul Hollier is expecting change as much as he hoped that with his coming forward and basing his comments on a first face-to-face discussion with the United States Air Force General, who did not beat around the bush and said that everything in Corso's book was true and more, that if they could come from a Canadian and just even having any kind of public hearings, that it might get the ball rolling in the American Congress. That's what, as he outlined to me, that's what his hope is.
And that's very admirable. I just don't think that knowing our position with we really don't have any real power in the Canadian-American politics arena. So knowing that, I, to be honest, don't think that it's going to happen.
But at least he's trying.
Yes,
and that is something
that
for a former that is something for a former Minister of Defense to do. He's actually trying. How many Minister of Defenses, i.e., people like Rumsfeld, have you ever seen putting themselves on the line and saying there really are extraterrestrials and advanced technology?
Well, good point there, Linda. Hey, thanks for the call, David. Appreciate you being on the program. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Hi, George. This is Rich from Cincinnati.
Hi, Rich. Good to have you with us.
Pretty good. I was just wondering if your guest had actually thought about the I know that one of the people she talked to said that it was unable to be cut or removed, but if there were tunnels going from this building to where the object was, that over the past 50 years they couldn't have removed it piece by piece through the tunnels to the building and out of there. And I have another question after that, if you don't mind.
Well, the only data that we have is from the United States Air Force pilot who says that he was in that tunnel and went in this object back in the early to mid-90s. He doesn't know anything firsthand after that, according to him.
Okay. And I was wondering if I was going to ask if the federal government was denying access, but I guess they have been letting people go out onto this property. I'm wondering over the past 50 years or so since this has happened, how there hasn't been enough people out there, especially knowing this information, to find out something about what's down there. Like you said, with the metal detectors and such. You know,
this has not been a publicly discussed story. This is an evolving story that has been really quite recent, since just the mid to late 90s. With some of the investigators, and then I've come into this on the basis of some of their work and being able to get in touch with this pilot and a few others. I'm very intrigued by both the people I've talked with, which doesn't prove what's down there, and the remote viewing is extremely interesting but does not prove. So we have a story that has a lot of components to it, going back into what appears to be at least 1953, if not earlier, and there is that huge triangle that is out there in the lake bed that the geologist said was definitely not made by nature. So you have these components, eyewitnesses, the U.S. Air Force pilot, the remote viewer, the now deceased Air Force captain. The captain and the pilot both had told the investigators in 93, who went down the coal chute, that they had firsthand knowledge that a vehicle from outer space had crashed in that lake bed. And so there's eyewitness testimony, which a lot of that in this field, but it doesn't prove it. And what everybody would like, and I'm sure you would too, I certainly would, how do we prove it? And if the government continues to hold all the cards of physical evidence until there is some kind of public disclosure, we're probably not going to be able to prove. But at least we are investigating, and I'm trying to share what we're learning with the public.
Linda, and again, how close can you get to it? Can you touch the sides of it?
You mean walk on that triangle?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We definitely walked around. And that was the strange thing. You're not aware of, you would think, looking at that aerial, that it would be very obvious.
Right.
Where the triangle is.
But when you're there, it's not. You can't really see
exactly
the depth. But how much dirt do you think is on top of the thing?
Well, I don't know. In the geology report that was done, in my Earth files, it's called Results of Geophysical Investigations, Vicinity of Desert Range Experimental Station. And this was done in August of 1999. This was with ultrasound and magnetometers. And the geologist who did this report was a Lamont Sorensen. And he did not find any anomalies in the sections. It did very fine drawings. I have his complete report of where they did their work. Well, it turns out they went to the far wide end, and they went to the far point. And both the remote viewer and the Air Force pilot and captain said that the burial was in the middle. What we need is some way to go over the entire triangle, perhaps with deep ground penetrating radar. And right now, as far as I know, there's no restriction on flying over it.
What are you doing next hour?
Want to fly over it?
No, I think we might keep you again. You want to hang around?
Sure.
I've got so many calls coming in for you. If to leave them all in the lurch, some people have probably waited 10 years to get on this program.
Yeah, let's go for it.
We might as well, and we'll do open lines at another time. And by the way, Ian Punnett will be on Saturday. I'll be here Sunday for a live program on the avian flu virus with Dr. Mark Siegel. You know, Linda, when people research this, as you have and other people as well, you've got to walk away just shaking your head, knowing what you know. I mean, how frustrating would it be if you weren't in the media, if you didn't have the platform to tell the world what you think is going on out there,
right?
But you could only keep this within yourself. That's got to be frustrating for some people.
Exactly, and that's why I think some of us have had people who have come forward, have told us a lot of astonishing things. They have died. No one knows who they were. No one knows which agency they worked for. But there have been downloads, and I will never forget. I don't know how close we are to coming up to break, but this was...
I got a minute.
Okay. I once was looking into the eyes of a man who had worked in a military unit that had been involved with the, we'll call it the non-humans, face-to-face. And he was Catholic, and he began to sob. And I realized that I was watching a human being who had grown up with a certain paradigm, who in his work, it was being shaken, and that he was sobbing, not because there was anything necessarily terrifying or awful at all, beyond the fact that dealing with extraterrestrial biological entities for real, as a Catholic, working in this particular military agency, was getting to him so much that he just broke down and cried.
When we come back, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to keep Linda Moulton-Howe. Linda, you have in your career indeed covered high strangeness stories. Is there any specific one of everything you've covered? Crop formations, chupacabra searches, UFOs, strange things, earth changes. Is there any one that really sticks out that just baffles you?
Well, it's interesting as you asked the question, what popped into my mind was in June of 1987, I was in Peru. I was there for a month traveling on my own. And I went to what is called the Coriri Festival. It is in the kind of ancient Inca tradition of going up high in the Andes to where the glaciers are because from their point of view, the Apu, or the god, was in the ice at the top of the Andes, and this was tied in with the Pleiades, interestingly enough. In June, when the Pleiades dropped down on the horizon for several days, they hold this festival, Coriri. It means sort of like star snow, and the tribes, Inca tribes, come from all over Peru. There can be 20,000 people there. At about 22,000 feet. And I wanted to go. I wanted to experience what it would be like to be among people who were literally relating to the sky, the stars, the snow, and basically rituals of redemption. And the idea is that the Pleiades go down, and they are, from the Inca point of view, looked at as kind of the rulers and the disciplinarians for some reason. And when they're gone for those few days, then that's when they say, please wipe all of our sins free and give us a new slate to start over the year. So I was with a group. There were half a dozen of us, and we started down in Cusco at about 14,000 feet in a van, and we drove up to probably somewhere around 16,000 feet. And the idea was we would switch over to horses, and we would take horses up the final rising up to the 22,000 feet at the Coriri Mountain. And that night, where we were camped, everybody had been in this tent where they had cooked some food and stuff, and it was warm. And the temperatures were going down, I mean, gosh, maybe 20 below at night.
Oh, that's cold.
But it, for me, that alien sky of the southern hemisphere every night, I never got tired of looking at it. I didn't care how cold it was. And we had Arctic clothes. And so I had left the tent. I was by myself outside looking at that incredible sky. and I've been staring at the Southern Cross in one direction, and sort of 90 degrees from it was what to me looked like a perfect isosceles triangle of stars in a pattern. And I remember that the only thing in my mind was just how absolutely beautiful it was, and yet how alien it was, because I was used to a northern hemisphere sky. And as I'm staring between that Southern Cross and that pattern of stars, this blast of light came out from inside of the triangle of stars, and then came another blast of light, and a third blast of light. And I realized that the three blasts of light were making a triangle inside of the triangle of stars. And I stood there sort of astonished. And at first, because I do have a mind that usually tries to go to Occam's razor, what is the simplest thing? And at first I thought, well, maybe there's a satellite that's tumbling and reflecting weirdly.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But then it happened a second time. At the second time, when there was that repeat, I thought, well, what in the world is happening here? And I yelled at the people in the tent, you got to come out here. There's lights moving in the sky. And I heard this, it's too cold. And I'm saying, no,
it's incredible. Right?
And now this is the part that in my mind, when you ask that question, because it still is one of the most astonishing things I've ever seen in my life. If you have ever seen Walt Disney movies where they would have that pen that would paint on the earth or paint in the sky.
Between
the Southern Cross coming straight from the center of the Southern Cross, as if somebody were drawing on a ruler, it was that straight, a white, blazing white line. We're not talking about like looking at a meteor moving. I mean, like somebody drew a line from the Southern Cross right to the center of that triangle of stars.
Like a Pong game, remember?
Well, just a straight line. I mean, and it was white, and it was blazing, and it was connecting the Southern Cross in the center of that triangle where the two rounds of blasts of light had been. And at that point, I am standing, I am looking at a line drawn in the sky. I am trying to get my friends out of the tent who don't want to come out into the cold, because this is absolutely, my mind cannot comprehend what is happening. And George, this stayed in the sky as a straight white line connecting the two things that I had been staring at the most. And I'm running to the tent, looking up in the sky, but I'm pulling open that tent flap. You guys have to come out here and be witness to this. And this is the weird thing, and you hear this in so many stories. I've heard this myself. As soon as some people finally started coming out of the tent, and I've been standing out there for, I don't know how many seconds, I'm going to say more than a minute.
Without any
line is up there.
Without any Russian vodka in your coat, right?
Okay. No, right. And what happens as soon as those people come out of the tent? It fades away.
Typical, right?
Yeah. Well, what in the world are these dramatic demonstrations like that?
And you know what? What if they were trying to communicate or to show you something?
Well, it was like a reflection of exactly where my attention had been. The Southern Cross and that pattern of triangle stars, and that's where all the action took place. But what could produce that kind of drama on that scale?
To the phones we go. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Blair in Sedona, Arizona.
Hi, Blair. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you, sir. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hey, one of the motives could be your evidence suggests that these alien crashes were deliberately crashed in remote areas, Linda,
mm-hmm.
you know, initiating what you might call and maintaining a secret technology for genetics trade with the government corporate entities that are, you know, on all of our countries. You know, basically, the thinking of this group could be, and I want you to comment on this, hey, these guys are on a precipice, you know, currently where self-annihilation may close a specific DNA chain in this universe. We better get it while it's going good.
Well, I'll tell you, I had the most interesting discussion with this Bill Foster, the one who saw this huge, huge triangle with his wife and another couple. And in asking him about having a life of what appeared to be abductions by what he thinks are these gray beings inside of this large triangle, what in the world is the purpose? He said, I really don't know. He said, I've been abducted 11 times from age 5 up to at least age 55, and I know that I've had instructions, and I know that I've had images running through my head. But, Linda, I cannot tell you except when I think about that question, he said, what occurs to me is whatever is going on, they're in control. It's their agenda. They're doing the abducting of humans. We're not doing abductions of them.
Yeah, and it's sort of like a first wave of Dr. Hertak comments about, you know, watch out for these first waivers of alien beings coming down because they mean no good, but they're after something that we've got, whether we're soul containers or a special DNA. We've got something that probably trumps them, but we have to get through this period and let them do their business, but realize that we hold the ultimate, I'm using trump card, once we work with our own spiritual growth. I think that George talks about that a lot, too.
Well, there's one thing that I would say has certainly been impressed upon me over the last 26 years. When I started into this story as a hard science and environment investigative reporter, simply trying to find out what was happening to animals in Colorado and around the world, and came face to face with law enforcement and a whole bunch of people who were telling me off the record, we're dealing with creatures from outer space. Why? What could possibly be the reason? And I had to try to accommodate a lot of paradoxes and contradictions. And part of it was, as I wrote in my book, An Alien Harvest, I was really, becoming convinced that we might be dealing with a survival issue at all levels. Our survival, that whatever the entities are, they've got a survival issue, and that there is definitely not just one, that there appears to be several at least, with different agendas. And I do not think that all of the non-human intelligences seem to have any negative focus on us. If there are one or two that, let's say, are indifferent to us because they have priorities, they have their own agendas, I think it becomes closer to that. That's my own personal opinion.
You know, I sometimes subscribe to what David Jacobs theorizes, that this is not all benevolent here.
No, it's not all benevolent from a human point of view, because there's no question that we're dealing with animal mutilations. We're dealing with a human abduction syndrome that is done against the will, or certainly not with the permission of the people. And probably one of the most disturbing pieces of the entire story has been animal mutilations. I know that I specifically have had two very focused threats from people allegedly working in our government who have said to me in two different parts of the country and two different years, we've tried to make it clear to you, we don't want animal mutilations and UFOs connected together in the public's mind, so lay off. And my attitude has always been sort of like Paul Hellyer's. I think that we, the public and the taxpayers, deserve to know everything that the government so-called servants know, and that if there is some issue in the animal mutilations that links to, let's say that there is some kind of a survival issue out there, we interpret animal mutilations to be repulsive and horrible, and a lot of animals have died. Well, what if there is a huge problem on the part of one of these life forms? We interpret it as not being positive, but maybe we are all in some kind of a huge survival boat.
Good point. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Barbara from Seattle.
Hi, Barbara.
I'm demon-possessed, and I had talked to your producer about doing a live exorcism, And things have gotten really erratic over here. And
what's going on with you?
He says he's not going to leave me until I'm dead and bleeding. Although I've been praying to God, and he's been helping a great deal.
How long has this been going on for you, Barbara?
He came out about 2 months ago, and he said that God said it was time for him to come out.
What state of mind were you in when you got possessed? How did this happen to you?
He said it happened when I was 9.
Ah, so it's been with you for a long time.
Yes.
Every day? Are you possessed every moment of the day?
Yes. And according to him, I didn't know he was there for years and years and years, but I've been saying things that I didn't mean. And
were you a particularly mean kid?
Yes, a little bit, yeah.
What's the worst thing you've ever done?
Worst thing I ever did is I had this tendency to sort of stare someone down and find their weak point and just rip them.
Like what? Give me an example.
It's really hard to say. It's just somebody has a weak point.
Okay, you mean like in their personality, some kind of flaw?
No, something they're very sensitive about. Something that would really hurt them.
Okay, so let's assume you're at a party and there's another woman there and she's got a problem with maybe the way she looks. You would spot that somehow from her and go right at that?
He would and go right at that.
He would.
And I would wonder why I said that. But he, like, if she was fat, he might say just something really cruel, something that would go into her psyche.
And what would this person do to you when you would say something like that, or he would say that?
What, the other person?
Yeah, I mean, would they attack you, cry, go away?
All of the above.
Okay, so for all these years then, this evil creature has been in you, and have you sought out any specific help? And I don't mean from God. I mean from some kind of exorcist or something like that.
I did recently. The Catholics are very difficult to get through their whole screening process.
Sure.
And I have called your program because you seem to know a lot of the exorcists. And they did talk about an on-air exorcism, but if you could pass my number along.
Well, I'll tell you what. We'll put you on hold. Put her on hold there, Karis, and Tom will get your number, and we will most likely get back to you with some kind of information. That's a strange one, Linda.
Yeah. I don't know. We're out of my field.
Oh, yeah. You're not into the exorcisms.
Nope.
Though I believe in your career, I bet you've come across some pretty bizarre entity stories, haven't you?
No, I would say that most of all of the stuff that I've investigated has always been focused on hard physical. And interestingly, one of the first people I went to in the animal mutilation investigation, which is highly physical, was a Catholic priest who did exorcisms in Denver. And when he took a look at the photographs and the evidence of the animal mutilations, he says this has absolutely nothing to do with satanic cults or exorcism.
Interesting. Interesting indeed. Well, Linda, we're going to take some more calls when we come back. Give us some more information about your website. A lot of people brand new to Coast to Coast, they come on by the thousands.
Right.
Go ahead.
It's www.earthfiles.com. Think of a reporter filing files about the earth, Earth Files. And my focus is environment, science, and real X-Files, grounded as much as I can make them in hard physical evidence, eyewitness testimony. And this world and this universe that we're in, I think, is fascinating to explore. It should not be put in some kind of policy of denial in the interest of national security. I think it affects us all, and that's what I'm trying to do at Earth Files, is report straightforwardly about what you don't see often on the 6 o'clock news.
All right, stay with us. Linda Moulton Howe and the rest of your phone calls, and I will be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Sean has those coordinates posted of this buried UFO or whatever it may be on the coasttocoastam.com website. So go up there, take a look at that. By the way, Linda, any more conferences ahead for you?
Starting in 2006, the first one that I would recommend a lot of Coast listeners to consider is the UFO Eureka Springs Conference. It's going to be in its 18th or 19th year, and it's held in that beautiful classic Victorian town called Eureka Springs. And there are usually 500 or so people in the audience every year. And the reason I like it and recommend it is that Lou Farish, who has been persisting with this conference, always brings together people who are working on facets of research about Earth mysteries that are not always what you've heard before. It's always something new. I always learn something there, and I'm always trying to bring a whole new research project to the Eureka Springs Conference. So if anybody is interested, I believe that all you have to do is in Google, type in the name Lou Farish, F-A-R-I-S-H, the UFO News Clipping Service. He's in Arkansas, and he does this wonderful conference every year. And that is kind of first up, always the first weekend in April.
Okay, back to the phones we go. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on the air, and thanks for holding. Hi there.
Good morning, George, Linda.
Yeah, hello.
This is Brad from Georgetown. I'm calling. My question is, Linda said that she was there on that mound in July.
Am I correct? Lake bed in July.
Okay. How big did you say this was again?
The triangle that is in the images is 4,400 feet on the two long sides and 2,700 feet on the shorter side.
Okay, they buried it because they couldn't haul it out, correct?
Well, the story that no one's been able to prove yet, but we have the Air Force testimony that there was a vehicle that was 150 feet long and 30 feet high that crashed right in the middle of the area that is now we'll call it the bulldozed triangle, and that the object was supposed to have been buried below the surface at what would be the center of this bulldozed triangle. One of the unanswered questions is why, if it is our government's construction project, why did they go to so much trouble to make such a huge triangle in that lake bed around where they buried something? The U.S. Air Force pilot that we heard the excerpt from says he thinks that it had to do with providing a target, perhaps for the extraterrestrials.
I'm going to get to my question. It kind of strikes me funny that, you know, they couldn't haul this thing out, and they dug such a big hole, and they buried it. I just kind of wondering how they got it over into the hole to get it covered up. And
the Air Force guy and the remote viewer both saw the same thing. I mean, one says it was his eyewitness testimony. The remote viewer saw the same thing and described it, that the object coming in at 3,000 miles an hour half buried itself where it came in, and that our government only had to bulldoze out and bury another half. That is the story.
Yeah, they didn't have to move it at all.
No, and it was half buried by impact.
Let's go to our international line. Your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes. My name's Corey. I'm calling from Edmonton.
Hello, Corey. Go ahead, sir.
Hi. I'd just like to say that the government actually probably does not know about anything about EB.
I'm sorry. I couldn't hear you, Corey.
Sorry, they don't want to know about EBEs, extraterrestrial biological entities, because they don't want to know. It's kind of like, you know,
Who doesn't want to know?
The government. The government doesn't want to know anything. It's kind of like saying, you know, like you're a father. The father doesn't want to know what the son is doing.
Well, but you got to remember
that if it's all true, what Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso wrote in the book The Day After Roswell, which I personally think is one of the most important books ever written in this area, he describes in many pages his own firsthand experience in the Pentagon with General Arthur Trudeau, who was a friend and colleague of Dwight D. Eisenhower, who became president, and that they were working together in a small unit for one specific reason, to learn as much as they possibly could about extraterrestrial biological entities interfacing with our planet, and that our government wanted their technology to back engineer and patent in American corporations, and they wanted to move forward as fast as possible as they could with the space program. All of that means that it was in the interest of the government to learn as much as possible, but that a decision was made to keep everything that was happening in a military, intel, and corporate level about extraterrestrials and their technology away from the public and the media, and that that policy is still in effect today. That means the governments know, in some units, they know a tremendous amount. The issue and the challenge, which Paul Hellyer is concerned about, I am concerned about, along with a lot of other people, is what is it going to take to make our government and other governments tell us everything that they know, which I think is a tremendous amount. It is not disinterest, and it is not that they don't know. It's that there is a policy of denial in the interest of national security.
The old saying, deny, deny, deny. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there. It's your turn.
Hi, George. How are you?
Fine. Thank you.
This is Jarrell. I'm calling from Nebraska right now. Been a long-time listener, and this is the first time I've ever called you.
Jarrell is a very different name.
Yeah, actually, I've wanted to call your show before regarding my name because it came from the Rosicrucian. So
wasn't that Superman's father's name?
No, it was Jor-El, and it had a hyphen in it. Mine does not.
All right.
Linda. Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Well, your program has brought back a lot of memories for me. I grew up in West Valley, just east of where you're talking about, out there in Garrison.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to go out to the hills that are right off of State Road 201, right off on the side there. And there is a lot of very strange energy, but I've never been down all the way down that road, so I haven't seen exactly what you're talking about. But one thing I wanted to let you know, when I was, it was about 16 years ago, we used to go up to Butterfield Canyon all the time. I don't know if you've been out there. Have you heard of Butterfield Canyon?
No.
Okay, it's southeast of where you're talking about this ship is supposed to be.
Right.
There was a lot of very strange things that happened out in Butterfield Canyon. There's a lot of people that have very odd stories of things that they've seen, lights kind of disappearing. You'd be driving down a road and you'd see lights coming at you, and there would be no turnoff on the road. It's, you know, all just a stretch of road in the middle of nowhere, and these lights would look like they would go over a hill, and then they would disappear.
Right.
And no car would pass you or anything. You're like, oh, okay. But the military started to have a presence up there, and then all of a sudden it got shut down. And nobody was allowed up there anymore. I don't know if it's open now. I haven't been up there in a while, but it's directly southeast of where you're talking about.
Well, I tell you, after talking with a lot of people who have lived there for a very long time, I am convinced that that whole area, the dry lake bed and perhaps going into the canyon that you're talking about, that people have seen truly high strangeness for a very long time, but like so much of the world, unless a reporter or somebody starts going around and talking to people, none of their stories would ever reach the light of day because everyone thinks that if they talk about it, that they will be ridiculed.
You know, Linda, what is truly remarkable would be the tremendous incidence of crashes. I mean, and we're just talking about in this country.
Right.
If you added them up around this planet, It could be 100. Who knows?
And why? Why exactly? Yeah.
I mean, if they had the technology to get here, and I still think if it's coming from interstellar space, they are coming through wormholes because they're not coming via, you know, propulsion that we understand right now. There's no way.
And some of them might truly be planted. I've talked with people in the military who said, we know, and this is basically a quote, we know that we were, quote unquote, given technology sort of gifts that ended up being dead ends. And maybe that was the purpose, to keep humans from going in one route that might have been more successful more rapidly, diverting attention down basically dead-end technology routes, and by the time it's discovered, they've gone on to something else. What that would all be about, I don't know, but that's been suggested several times by people who have been in military and intelligence, saying we're dealing with deception, not meaning that it is hurting people specifically, but that it's putting us down dead ends. And that raises all kinds of questions about bigger agendas.
Jacques Vallée, his book, Messengers of Deception.
Right, exactly.
That's very, yep, much like that.
I keep getting emails from people who are, either something I have not said clearly. I've tried to stress that huge triangle by the statements by the actual U.S. Air Force people, and then also in the remote viewing, it was made by bulldozers or some kind of big machinery. The crash itself was by an object that was not triangular shaped and was not 4,400 feet long. The U.S. Air Force man's testimony is that he knew of an oval-shaped craft, 150 feet long by 30 feet high. If that came in, 150 feet by 30 feet at 3,000 miles an hour into that lake bed, it might have gone in pretty deeply. But the big triangle is something that was constructed around that area in that lake bed. So there's two big issues. What was the purpose of doing this huge triangle? And why was it, if it's constructed in 53 or 52, why was it constructed specifically around a place that they buried this object, this aerial vehicle from outer space? There's so many mysteries about this huge triangular lake bed feature.
Is there any way in 1953 this could have been a man-made object?
Well, that's not what the remote viewer got, and it's not what that U.S. Air Force pilot or the captain.
So they saw.
The captain said that he had firsthand knowledge from a colleague in the Defense Intelligence Agency, and that it was a craft considered to be an extraterrestrial vehicle that came down in that lake bed. And then the U.S. Air Force man that I interviewed and we had an excerpt from said that the last time he had been out there was in the early to mid-90s, and that the object was still there, but he did not know what the status was now. So the eyewitness testimony of these people doesn't prove it, but you have to put it all together and say that from the locals who have lived there for a long time, from the, we'll call them the Air Force people, the remote viewing by Joe McMonagle, which was so accurate on so many details, all of it says we're dealing with something that was not terrestrial.
What a story. Absolute story. Wild card line, you're on the air. Hi there. There he is.
Texas?
Yeah, go ahead.
Last night, your guest about the Stardust, he had mentioned something about every 13,000 years that the pristine material is jettisoned out.
Yes.
I just wanted to point out, and I also have a question for your guest, that kind of coincides with the events of 10,500 BC, as far as 13,000 years. And for your guest, I just wanted to ask the story you were telling earlier about Peru and the high altitude.
Right.
isn't that the only place on Earth where you can see the Zeta Reticulum system?
When you get into the southern hemisphere, that is the only hemisphere that you can see Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2 from. You can't see it in the northern hemisphere.
That's a good point.
For me, that was not my focus. My focus was on that southern cross in this very strange triangle of stars. And the Zeta Reticulum 1 and 2 story, I think, which keeps emerging in the internet, in all of this SERPO dialogue, takes me back to the early 1980s when Astronomy Magazine did a huge article. I mean, it was 15, 16 pages long. I still have that magazine, and it was December 1974. We're at December 2005. This was a long time ago. And they focused this 16-page article with color graphics on Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2. They called it the Zeta Reticuli incident. And they showed the star system that Betty Hill, from the Betty and Barney Hill abduction in New Hampshire in 1961, had drawn under hypnosis. They then showed the painstaking work that Marjorie Fish, an astronomer, had put together using color beads on strings to try to look at what Betty Hill had drawn in a 3D way. And then they showed what a modern computer had generated for that particular part of our end of the solar, or of the galaxy. And the matches were extraordinary.
They were almost identical, weren't they?
Yeah. And over time, when I think how many times the binary star system, Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2, has come up, whether it was in the abduction syndrome or talking with people in the military who claimed that they had knowledge or intel or whoever, that binary star system is out there 37.5 or approximately 37 light years from our sun. And on that map...
We got the clock here, Linda.
Okay.
Got to go. Yeah,
where Betty had drawn, she had our sun, was on that star map.
Hey, thanks, Linda. Look, I won't talk to you until probably after Christmas, so you have a wonderful Christmas.
And happy holidays to you and all our listeners.
Linda Moltenhau for Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there.